my lab, you know, we're trying to develop epigenetic approaches. So every AML has a different constellation of mutations. So does that mean everybody's going to need a different therapy? So my lab has been trying to understand what are the enzymes, like acetyltransferases or methyltransferases, what are the enzymes that control self-renewal of the leukemic cell? Because all leukemia cells have to self-renew. And what's the basis for that?
Welcome to the Oncology Insights Podcast, a weekly show where you'll find cutting-edge insights and everything that's working at the forefront of oncology.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm delighted that today I have a dear friend, a renowned figure in oncology, Dr. Steven Nimer. And so he's going to be my guest on the Oncology Insight Podcast. Steve is a distinguished figure in American medicine, a clinician scientist, a renowned expert on leukemias. He's currently the director of the NCI designated Comprehensive Cancer Center at Sylvester, which is the University of Miami, previously a leader at Sloan Kettering. And Steve, first of all, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Thrilled you could join us. And what I'd like to start off with is just your journey, because it's so interesting how people end up essentially evolving in their careers. And then now you're obviously in a leadership role where you have an international impact. And so please share that with the audience, and then we'll get into the specific diseases.
Well, I thought I should probably start when I was 3 years old.
Perfect.
Just kidding. Yeah. But I was raised in a suburb just outside of Chicago. I was born in Chicago. And one of my parents was born in Moldova. The other was born in Germany. They came and met in Chicago, raised a family. And interestingly, both my father and my mother went to college. And so education was stressed a lot. And somehow doing something for the good of society and the world. And so becoming a doctor was the kind of the very traditional blend of science and compassion and the science and art of medicine was very attractive to me. I went to the University of Chicago for medical school and met some amazing role models there. One is Dr. Janet Rowley, who taught me as a second-year medical student. And the other was a really amazing hematologist named Dan Roth, who ultimately went up to the state of Washington to practice. But they made hematology so exciting as a discipline. When I was a medical student, I actually made a diagnosis by looking at a blood smear that the head of hematology hadn't made. Of Thal Minor. And so I thought it was the best possible thing. You could look at a drop of blood from a patient and figure out what was wrong. You know, did they have AML or ALL or CLL or whatever, hemolytic anemia from the blood smear. It was like an immediate reward where if you looked at the blood, you could figure out what was going on. And so after that, I went to UCLA. They had one of the strongest leukemia and bone marrow transplant programs. I was very fortunate. Dick Champlin and David Goldie were two of my mentors there, leaders in the field. And, you know, what I learned there and have brought with me ever since is, you know, you got to understand the patient. You could look at all the prognostic scoring systems, and what do the numbers show? But I really was fascinated by trying to understand the impact of the disease on the patient and their family. And also had the opportunity to teach interns, residents, fellows, et cetera. And then also as a fellow, I was very disturbed. This was the pre-cyclosporin era. So I was doing allogeneic transplants. And there was just nothing to do for these patients when they had graft versus host disease or, you know, got into other trouble. And so I decided I really needed to have a lab. I couldn't just take care of patients and hope that someone else would make some advance someday that would help all these patients that were trying to be cured of their cancer. And so I started in the lab, and I worked on GM-CSF, which was expressed by T cells, activated T cells. I somehow thought that I would help dissect graft versus host disease from graft versus leukemia by studying the products of T cells and the subsets of T cells. And that didn't ultimately pan out, but I also, in the clinic, conducted some of the phase one trials of GM-CSF, IL-3. I have the distinction of actually giving IL-6 to human beings, and now we try to block its effects. It's much better to block it than to give it. And so I had a blend of the clinical, where I became sort of an expert on bone marrow failure and leukemia. And in my lab, I was studying these growth factors and what they did. So I think an important part of my journey at UCLA was when David Goldie left. Okay, he was the head of hematology. He moved to Sloan Kettering. And I was given a lot of things, even tenure as an assistant professor, to try to stay at UCLA. I worked in Judy Gasson's lab, who was a great person on the science side. But over time, I missed the mentorship. I missed being able to talk about the difficult cases with someone who knew 10 times more than I did. And so after a year and a half at UCLA, I then moved after David Goldie to Sloan Kettering and had an amazing time there, almost 20 years. I broadened out in terms of, so I was responsible for lymphoma and myeloma, auto and allo transplants. And I was very, I spent a lot of time making sure clinically I knew what was going on in all these fields, not just myeloid diseases. You know, I took care of some amazing people. In New York, it changed me as a person. I took care of a lot of the average New Yorkers who were very demanding, you know, in the pre-internet Google era. The patients would come in with a lot of thick clippings from the Wall Street Journal, or a House and Garden had a new treatment for some cancer that the patients would come. There was a million questions. Everybody asked a million questions. It was being on the Upper East Side of New York at a cancer center. And as head of hematology there, all the New Yorkers wanted to see the chief. So that was super interesting. And the other thing I would say, because you do this and other people do this, the amount of, I won't even call it pro bono because that's like a legal term, but the number of people who send you records on their family members or their friends, and late at night, there you are looking at the time, you know, a 60-page thing of medical records from somebody with an unfortunate blood cancer or something. And then the next day you call the family back, you call your friends around the country, you call, you know, everybody, you spend hours and hours and hours. And over the course of our careers, which spans decades, you know, God knows how much time we spend to help human beings. And I don't think this comes across. I don't think we present ourselves well enough to the public. I mean, any individual is very grateful for what we do. But I also think that you and your leadership roles, or me, you know, you just help take care of so many people. It's one of the best things. And our field, I love the fact that we've got new cures for people. And so, you know, just how many people we could help. So the last part of the journey, about 13 years ago, I was approached by Donna Shalala and the dean of the University of Miami to think about coming to South Florida and build something. I really had been to Miami like for 2 days my entire life. But you know, it had been called the sixth borough of New York since COVID. It's certainly, you know, there's like a million New Yorkers who live down here now. But it seemed like in New York, there was five or six cancer centers within a couple of miles of each other if someone wanted to get an expert opinion. But not in Miami, really. There was only one university, University of Miami. And the cancer center there, I would just say, when I was there and looking at it, they were trying to be the best cancer center in Miami. And they could have gotten rid of about 80% of the people, and they still would have been the best in Miami, but really hadn't thought about how to build something that could be competitive nationally. And that was very attractive to me. And Donna and the dean were willing to commit resources. And so that's been really my focus for the last 13 years. I still have a lab. This week on Monday, one of my R01 grants, I had to do the competitive renewal. So I got that in. So I still have my lab and I still don't see too many patients. But as you said, we got National Cancer Institute designation in 2019. We renewed that last year. And it's just, I've recruited over 300 faculty since I've been here. And so it's been one of the more important things in my life is to build something. You know, there was a lot here. There were a lot of people who were excellent here, chronically under-resourced. And part of it has been also to build the heme malignancy stuff, which we've been able to recruit a number of top people.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
I remember when you called me prior to taking the job, you were in your car driving somewhere on vacation. You asked my advice. It was a number of years ago, and I'm so thrilled you took it, and I'm so proud of everything you've accomplished. It's quite amazing.
You know, it's a great team here. You know, again, you become a doctor circling back so you could help others. And I'm fond to tell people also, you know, you take care of patients one at a time.
Yeah.
Right. But when you're teaching your fellows, they can go out and take care of people, or you hire people. But fundamentally, and that relationship is so important, that one-on-one.
We are blessed to be in this field. There's no question about it. Great rewards. So now let's talk about specific diseases. You're renowned for your work in both acute myelogenous leukemia and the myeloid dysplastic syndromes. And what I'd like to start off with is acute myelogenous leukemia and sort of update the audience on where we are.
You know, there was a time when the discoveries in hematology were leading everybody. The solid tumor people were so jealous of us. We had cures for Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's, hairy cell leukemia, a lot of these things. AML has been a very difficult disease. If you look at the curve, survival curve, decade by decade by decade, for most people, the people over age 60, there's been very little progress made. And so the five-year survival is still dismal for the average patient with AML. If you're younger than 60, if you get a stem cell transplant, the cure rates continue to slowly climb. We've managed a lot of the toxicity. And so for many people, if you're not good prognosis and in first remission easily, the way to get the cure is a transplant. And back when, you know, we trained, you had to be under 60 for sure. And then it was a little 65, 70, 75, you know, now it's really physiologic age. But it's one of the areas where precision medicine has been, in my mind, not a failure. It's just not a great success. With Gleevec in CML, I think we all thought that tyrosine kinase inhibitors and things would be better. But you know, only FLT3, the FLT3 drugs, those are the only ones that are FDA approved. And they're the benefit is modest. The IDH inhibitors work, and those are some amazing successes. Thinking of AML, you've got to mention acute promyelocytic leukemia. And I've done some stuff on there, and we've both had a colleague, Marty Tallman, who's done a lot of stuff in APL. That's a huge success, right? Like, if you're at a major center and you get APL, you should be cured, you know, over 95% of those people.
And that's biologic therapies rather than historic chemotherapy, which is amazing.
So, but the other stuff, you know, we find TET2 mutations and DNMT3A mutations and ASXL1 and things. And yet nothing in any of these is truly targetable with success. And I'd say the major accomplishments, like venetoclax and azacitidine, okay? So for the elderly people that wouldn't tolerate chemotherapy, that offers some significant prolongation of life. But again, it's not like a game changer, right? And we're still giving like 7+3, which is like 45 years old. Is that something? Yeah, so many wonderful scientists have been in this field. The first cancer ever to be sequenced, right? And reported by Tim Lay. So they spent millions and millions of dollars to sequence an AML patient first. And so we have mouse models and we have all these things. But for the patients, if you have AML and you're 70 years old, bad. It's bad.
Yeah. It's also challenging to bring new drugs into AML therapy because the patients are so ill after they fail the initial treatments with historic infections, pancytopenia. So you have to have better strategies.
I think also, because MDS is something there too, what we don't realize is the reserve of the hematopoietic compartment when you're 70 is limited. Whatever you want, you can count this cell or that cell. But when you give someone 7+3 or whatever, and they have to recover, and that can take a long time, and the recovery can be incomplete, and then you have to give more chemo again and again and hope you can get them through infections and everything else. And I think we don't really understand, like, if you have a cancer when you're 70, and now we know you may have had CHIP before and other things, you've had maybe decades for your cancer to figure out how to grow and evade. And it looks just like a normal stem cell with a few, maybe there's CLL1 expression or a little more IL3 receptor on there, but looks a lot like a normal stem cell. Body has got a lot of ways to protect those cells. So I think it's one of the toughest cancers. We got to come up with like a checkpoint inhibitor strategy that would work in this disease or something that won't target the normal stem cells and wipe out your bone marrow.
And the microenvironment in AML, you mentioned checkpoint inhibitors. What are your thoughts in terms of opportunities related to stimulating the body's own immune system, or where are we with CAR T cells for the treatment of AML?
Most of this stuff hasn't worked yet. And so, as you know, the lymphoma or the ALL CAR T, if you wipe out all your B cells for a while or forever or whatever, you know, you can get by. And with AML, the question is there a target for this stuff? And now, you know, with the souped up CAR T, where you deliberately, supercharge T cells. And in that regard, there are some things where they're dual targeting two cell surface molecules or something that are rarely found together on a normal stem cell that are on AML. So sometimes, you know, CD7 or something could be on a AML, not just on the T cells, and then CD123 and some of these other markers, CLL1. the CD30, you know, CD33 had been thought to be something important. Mylotarg, modest activity, right? Very targeting CD33. So I think we still have a lot of discovery to make. What's the target? But I think perhaps with a dual targeted CAR T, you know, the bispecific antibodies is not, you know, it's just super difficult in AML because you can't wipe out normal hematopoiesis.
Yeah, very challenging.
What's interesting is a lot of work to suggest that there's a symbiotic relationship between abnormalities in the microenvironment and abnormalities in your stem cells. You know, David Scadden did some work a long time ago with Dicer, right? So they knocked out Dicer, and it turned out that they got like MDS, AML in the microenvironment. But the leukemia that develops in a Dicer knockout mouse can't be propagated in a normal mouse. It can only be propagated in a Dicer knockout mouse. And so it implies that the microenvironment has some very specific signaling. The other thing that's disappointing, and my lab, you know, we're trying to develop epigenetic approaches. So every AML has a different constellation of mutations. So does that mean everybody's going to need a different therapy? So my lab has been trying to understand what are the enzymes, like acetyltransferases or methyltransferases, what are the enzymes that control self-renewal of the leukemic cell? Because all leukemia cells have to self-renew, and what's the basis for that? So we've thought, you know, targeting P300, targeting CARM1, some of these enzymes that can be inhibited, maybe they're really uniquely playing a role in leukemia stem cell self-renewal, and that the normal stem cell has a little bit more plasticity, can tolerate being targeted. We're also trying to identify what are the enzymes that block differentiation, right? So maybe just like the IDH inhibitors or ATRA, maybe we're going to have a global approach to stimulating differentiation of AML, because the precision medicine stuff, it's like, does every single patient need a different therapy? And that would be tough.
Though it is clear that with allogeneic transplantation and the immune response against the AML, there are cures. So we do know that there's an immunologic method to potentially cure some of the patients. And how that can be expanded is critical.
So again, part of it is also the allo effect, right? Because auto transplants for leukemia don't really work. And so it's not about, as we learned for allotransplant, it's not about the high-dose chemotherapy. But the other thing that's not been explored much are like NK cell therapies for AML, because there's evidence that they make a difference, whether it's a correlation versus causation, unclear.
Now switch to MDS now. That actually is a big basket, many different entities, many different ways you can get myelodysplastic syndrome. Also very challenging, not much progress in the last few decades.
You know, I didn't pick the right diseases.
Maybe for the audience's sake, just describe what MDS is.
So, you know, I mentioned a little earlier that I got very interested in bone marrow failure. And so the two main types of bone marrow failure, one is aplastic anemia, which in general is an autoimmune attack against your stem cells. And the other is myelodysplastic syndromes, where about two-thirds of all the patients who die from MDS die from effects of cytopenias and bone marrow failure. And about a third will evolve to leukemia over time. And so they then, it's more difficult to treat than, I've been telling you how hard AML is, but AML that's evolved out of MDS is even more difficult to treat. I'm thinking it's now more than 15 years, but in a period of 2 years, three drugs got approved. 5-azacitidine, decitabine for MDS, and then for 5Q minus MDS, lenalidomide or Revlimid got approved. If you have 5Q minus today, you would get lenalidomide. And then if you fail, you would get something. Okay, so there's not even a replacement. Like in myeloma, you can fail one of these IMIDs and there's others that you can take. There's no other IMID that's out there if you fail lenalidomide for 5Q minus, which is a good prognosis MDS. It just says that it's been difficult to develop drugs in this disease.
Let me ask you, lenalidomide and myeloma, it has both a direct cytotoxicity to the myeloma cell, but also an immune response against the myeloma. And is this the case in MDS as well?
Not well documented. You know, I think that there's a lot in the myeloma field about the effects of lenalidomide on the microenvironment and things, changing cytokine levels. You know, the targets is Ikaros and Aiolos, I think, the zinc finger transcription factors. And a different target in 5Q minus MDS. But not so much known about the immune system. And then the azacitidine, which is widely used, and decitabine, which is less widely used. Maybe decitabine has something special in P53 mutant disease. There have been a number of papers about the responsiveness. But in general, you know, a third of the patients respond to these drugs with a meaning. You don't have to have a partial remission to have a survival benefit from azacitidine. But about a third of the patients have a partial response or better. If you fail those things, there's not much out there. Again, like AML, allotransplant, if you can, is the way to go. It's the only way to cure the disease. And then the other stuff that's come since, it's been very focused on anemia. So luspatercept is now FDA approved. It's better than EPO. Looks like it's better than EPO for anemia in this disease. And then there's a bunch of drugs that are either FDA approved or coming, which is like an oral version of decitabine or an oral version of azacitidine. And they may be marginally better. And of course, it's easier to take a pill than to have to go to the doctor to get a shot all the time. But it's another reflection of the inability to target the mutations or things. And so because allotransplant can cure MDS also, the question is, can you use immunologic methods to target MDS cells and to get effective treatments?
The individual with MDS, is there enough residual normal hematopoiesis that you could ever treat it and cure it without doing an allotransplant of some sort?
I think that, some of these, not everybody with MDS is 72 years old. And so I think that when you get in, there's children with MDS as well. So I think you want to find the people who have advanced bone marrow failure and have like bad stem cells. It's difficult, right? But the people who still have some reasonable bone marrow function, and a lot of times, you know, the disease presents only with anemia. Even if you have blasts in your bone marrow, maybe the only thing is anemia, maybe not clinically significant neutropenia. But then, there are patients for whom they have enough, they should have enough function themselves, and then there's some people who may not. And that's one of the things I'm very interested in doing some mathematical modeling of this. Because in the mouse, you can do some of this stuff, and it's rather predictive. But we don't have the test, like a flow cytometry test, that can tell somebody, you know, how many stem cells does this guy got if we wiped out the MDS? And I think that's it's a really important area.
You know, it's interesting you brought up in the mouse. I saw the NIH directive just a few days ago that we're going to be asked to abandon any sort of animal testing as we advance therapeutics. And that'll be a challenge for many of us to rethink how we do some of this work. I'm curious about your thoughts.
What I would say is the devils will be in the details. But as you know, for every protocol that we do currently with mouse, the first question that's asked is, are there alternative ways to study what you're studying besides the mouse? So don't, you know, the life of every animal is important. And so don't just use a bunch of mice if you could figure things out. And so one of the things that's in some of the discussion is, could you use artificial intelligence to predict what's going to happen in some of the mouse experiments? And as you know, sometimes we need to acquire statistical significance for our studies and this number of mice. I believe that for some diseases, mice are super important for discovery. I think most of us will agree. You can't, if a therapy works in a mouse, it doesn't mean it'll work in a human. And so my hope would be that they'll look at mouse experiments as a component of an overall plan that makes sense. And I find that, you know, we can overreact to all the criticism that, like, make America healthy again. You know, if you read it, it's actually a lot about preventing disease. Okay, it's not, who wouldn't want to prevent disease? And some of the new guidelines for NIH grants, it's really not so much about whether you're at Harvard or your environment. It's more about, like, are you asking an important question, and do you have a good approach, right? And can you get it done? Are you yourself a serious scientist that you'll get stuff done? So I think that we could always improve on everything, the way we do science, the way we do animals, the way we take care of patients, the way we communicate. So I think it's not bad to be challenged a little bit, but I also think for anything, before you destroy X, we should have a plan to build something new Y, right? Instead of just, this is no good, that's terrible, this doesn't work, shutting everything down is not a way to make any progress.
It'll be a challenging period, but I agree with you. It's also an opportunity to think creatively about what other options we'll have.
You know, every patient, I think you probably have these patients too. The first thing they ask you is, do you share your information with everybody else, right? And so some of this, I think we could always do, and we do. I see you every year at the ASH meeting, and we talk about our research and all that, and I see you at other meetings as well, and we're all talking about things. But I think when you're in challenging times, as you said, you know, working together, we can overcome some things, but we have to have a vision of what we need to build. I think to just say, don't tear this down, don't tear that down, we're saying that. But I think they're asking us to come up with something different, and maybe there's some opportunities. I don't know.
As a leader and as the director at the Sylvester Cancer Center, University of Miami, what are your major strategic initiatives?
You know, my mentor told me that if you want to win the high jump, you find one person who can jump 7 feet. You don't hire 7 people who can all jump 1 foot. Okay. And so we're very focused on building a few programs that could be like the best in the world. Our myeloma program is one area where we've made major investments. Sarcoma is another area, major investments in surgery, in the lab, in medical oncology, in pediatrics and things like that. One of the things I'm very focused right now is children's cancer. All the precision medicine that we have in adults, How is it impacting what goes on with children's cancer? So we're trying to work across the state of Florida to handle things. Brain tumors is another area, very focused on making progress there. We set up a pancreas cancer research institute. I think my message to our community, because, you know, when I got there, Sylvester had a very poor brand recognition. No one really, if you just said Sylvester, no one knew what you're talking about. And through a lot of things, including our annual bike ride, you know, thank you. I hit you up to support my bike ride every year. But we get people to know, you know, that what Sylvester is and what we're meeting. And we've also invested hugely in survivorship, right? So that all the patients who are out there who are worried about relapse or worried about getting back to their life. So we've got a few areas, can't do everything at once. Besides myeloma, we've got strong leukemia and transplant stuff going on. And the other, we're working with City of Hope regularly on some collaborations, and we want to be a reliable partner for pharma. We want to be a reliable partner for all the academic places. So if we do too many things, you know, can't do everything at high quality.
Well, what are you doing in the cellular therapeutic space? Do you produce any on campus, or is it all partnerships with pharma?
We recently have a new head of our transplant and cellular therapies, Damian Green, who came from the Fred Hutch. And we've been focused more on resistance mechanisms. We've got some really interesting data on why people don't respond well, or what's the basis of relapse other than losing the antigen where the CAR T is directed and things like that. Damian did some really interesting work with gamma secretase inhibitors, showing that for BCMA, which is cleaved by gamma secretase, you can markedly increase the amount of antigen on the surface of the target cells and maybe make the CAR T much more effective at eliminating things. So we have cellular therapy generation capabilities, but we felt that we were relying on others. You know, you guys are making things, and NCI, and there's companies. And so we haven't had the talent until Damian. And then the question is, can we make an important contribution?
And in the precision medicine space, what are you doing at the University of Miami?
So we're, in the solid tumors, you know, the problem with talking about precision medicine in AML and MDS is that almost nothing works. So it's not so easy. But in the solid tumors, you have to say, like, take melanoma, right, in the MEK inhibitors and the RAF inhibitors and stuff. These things have worked transiently, and then they've failed. And so we're trying to do multi-omics like everybody else and try to identify targeted pathways that could be targeted, even independent of mutations. Because I just think we were very naive. And again, mentioning Gleevec, I think we thought we would be able to find the mutation, BRAF is mutated, we give the inhibitor, and the cancer is going to go away forever. So I think that we are doing a lot of transcriptomics and proteomics and metabolomics. And then with AI and just dealing with big data, maybe we'll get some better insights into things.
Well, Steve, this has been just a delightful time talking with you. I look forward to seeing you in person in the near future. And I'm going to say goodbye at this point and let our audience enjoy this podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed this very much. And this is important. Great to see you.
Take care.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent with APA Time Zone Hassle. delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.